And welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Wednesday, September 25th, 2024. Survivors of Tuesday's road ambush in Juba narrate the treatment they received from the abductors.
They were like, we are going to release you, but they are going to tell us to run. If we don't run, they might change their mind to kill us. So they counted, wake up, face there, and run. So that's how we took off.
And the former commissioner of Maban County says his record is clean.
To close this case, these vehicles should be given back to the county. Then he's free to do whatever he wants to do, join what, we don't have any problem. But we want the property of the associate of the county to be given back to the county.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. 6 survivors of Tuesday's road ambush along the Juba Nimule Road who were freed by their captives say they are grateful to be alive. They say the armed men warned passengers against using the Juba Nimule Road. For VOA News, Dennis Logonyi spoke to some of the survivors and reports from Juba.
Some passengers of Bebeto bus who were abducted during an ambush on the busy Juba Nimule Road were released Wednesday after spending hours in the bush. Obama Great is a South Sudanese who survived yesterday's road ambush. She describes how armed attackers ordered some passengers at gunpoint to cross the road and move to an unknown location.
Some remain on the roadside, others they took us to the bush. They're like, yes, we follow them, but not seeing them. Head down, you just follow. You walk slowly, they will shoot you. So after like 30 minutes to 40, they will tell you, okay, you rest. We rest a bit, wake up, we go. So we started moving until to their place. We waited there. They were like, but put your head down flat, nothing. So we just follow also their orders, and then we waited for the rest. I think with their commander, we don't know. So he came and briefed us that for us, we don't have any issue with you civilians. What we are fighting is the government. Honestly, they did not touch whether raping or what, but they came, people.
Oba says she believes their release was an act of divine intervention.
They were like, we are going to release you, but they are going to tell us to run. If we don't run, they might change their mind to kill us. So they counted, wake up, face there, and run. So that's how we took off. We ran. So some of the teams, we are divided. So this is the team that we came together because we're like, we should stick together. The bush is too big. You cannot know, even the grass is up to here. We are just walking. You don't see. The legs are all just being cut with the grass. Some of them, they don't have shoes until we got even lost.
Kabugudo Anthony is a political attaché at the Ugandan embassy in South Sudan. He says his country will work with the South Sudan government to stop attacks on roads connecting Uganda and South Sudan.
We need to come together as a region to fight some of these elements, to contest some of these elements. Because if we leave them to continue moving around the region, we are all getting affected now. It's no longer a problem of South Sudan, but it's a problem of the region. It's a problem of Africa. That we shall not leave it to only the government of South Sudan. We, as Uganda, we commit our continued support to the government of South Sudan to make sure that these problems are solved.
Major General Lu Rai Kong, spokesperson of the South Sudan People's Defense Forces. SSPDF says the number of wounded from Tuesday's incident has risen to 9. Lu Rai blamed the runt or NAS for the attack, but Suba Samuel, NAS spokesperson, called Lu, in his words, a perennial liar. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
From Juba, we go to Upper Nile State, where the residents of Maban County are threatening to drag the former county commissioner to court if he does not return county vehicles. The former commissioner, who defected to the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, loyal to President Salva Kiir on Monday, says his records are clean. For VOA News, Mamer Abraham Kwot reports from Malakal.
Upper Nile State Governor James Odok Oyae suspended Peter Alberto, commissioner of Maban County, on Monday. Alberto is accused of selling 4 government vehicles as well as mismanaging public funds. James Daoud, the chairperson of the Youth Committee in Maban County, says he will consult the Investigations Committee before starting legal action against the former commissioner.
To close this case, these vehicles should be given back to the county. Then he's free to do whatever he wants to do, join what, we don't have any problem. But we want the property of the associate of the county to be given back to the county. we have to meet with the committee first. What is their reaction about collecting this vehicle back? If they refuse, then we can open this case.
Upper Nile State's Minister for Information, James Bacha, says Alberto was suspended after he traveled to Juba without seeking prior permission from Governor Oyai.
The same day the committee arrived in Maban from Upper Nile State, he left to Juba without the permission from the state government, from the governor. That is why the governor suspended him immediately.
Andrew Kwey, an elder in Maban County, says community members are happy to see the commissioner was suspended. Alberto says he already has returned the vehicles to the county committees.
It was the committee that came from the state for distributing the vehicles of the acted organization that left, that was phasing out. They gave us four vehicles. The committee took two and they left four. Those four vehicles, one was given to me as a private car by the committee that was formed from the state and sent to distribute the vehicles. The three vehicles, I gave them to the parliament chief, the youth leader, and the woman leader, three of them, including four motorbikes. Their vehicles are with them now.
Alberto says he left the county without informing the governor because the governor had not been answering his calls.
He's not picking my call. He only calls the community leaders. He does not call me. And there is something fishy about that. And that is the true conspiracy against the system. Those who decided to do the chaos, some of them were arrested. And then he was the one who ordered for them to be released. They were released. And when he came, he was even disobeyed.
Pogbot Baluang, Director for Information in the Office of the First Vice President Riek Machar, says investigations will continue to establish the facts about the allegations against Alberto.
The investigations committee is moving forward to thoroughly assess the situation and present their findings to the public. We believe transparency and accountability are paramount in addressing the issue facing Maban County residents. It is our firm belief that justice must prevail. We will continue to monitor the situation closely and remain committed to upholding the principles of good governance and rule of law in South Sudan.
Maban County is under SPLM-IO rule, according to the revitalized agreement on the resolution of the conflict in South Sudan. Pork says the party will soon submit the name of a party member who will replace Alberto. Maban County young people staged a protest on September 9th, accusing the commissioner of selling vehicles and imposing hefty fines on traders for his own benefit. For VOA News, I am Amera Bramcourt, reporting from Upper Nile State's capital, Malakal.
From Malakal, we move to Eastern Equatoria State, where some communities are still practicing wife inheritance, a custom or law that requires a widow to marry her deceased husband's brother. A number of communities in Eastern Equatoria State practice wife inheritance. Some widows who have gone through the cultural tradition say it has done more harm than good. For VOA News, Kaltuma Vanessa reports from Torit.
Leveret marriage, locally known in Eastern Equatoria State as Ojungo, is still a practice that is in use in some parts of the state. Matthew Oduma, a chief at a local court in Torit Town, says many women have suffered at the hands of the brothers of their deceased husbands.
Don't spoil the widows. You leave the woman without giving her food and taking responsibility of her children. And then if she finds another man, the family of the deceased husband comes and asks for payment. If you are the brother, change your behavior. You are supposed to take responsibility of the woman and her children, not the deceased properties for yourself. And if this is brought to court, it is cheating. What if you are the one dead? It is the children to take the properties of their father.
Rose Akongo is a resident of Ilangi in Torit Town. She says when her husband died, his brother inherited her and the family cattle her husband left for their children.
anen dit ni nial init ni nial de al de kulu be mederes saman na jagen mo ana gal be meken be
sai. I have two kids and they are in school, and when I started staying with him I thought he would help me, but he has not helped at all, not even feeding me and my children. It reached when I wanted to take my boy to school. I wanted to sell the cattle my husband left for me to pay the boy's school fees. Instead, he took the cattle and sold it and sent me out of his home. He also put me in prison for 6 months. He has not put my children in school after selling all the cattle.
Annabel Idiongo is another woman who had to marry the brother of her deceased husband. She says her first husband have two children. Idiongo says wife inheritance should be discouraged in South Sudan because it leads to suffering for the woman and her children.
Rajel tay ana kan gen bo kwes saman kan kirikmos ja obi jibo guma set le.
I used to be happy with my husband during Christmas. He will buy new clothes for all the children, but this man I am with, since he inherited, he has bought nothing for the children. He doesn't mind. Leveret marriage is a bad practice because this man has a wife already, and when I accepted to be with him, his wife will not leave me in peace. She will be insulting me.
Oboya Henry Lotomia sees things differently. Henry says wife inheritance comes with a lot of responsibility and insists that he takes care of his deceased brother's wife and children on top of his own family.
This is the direct product myself. I own all the property. In case of anything happening within the family, I'm responsible. I'm taking care of the family of my brothers. Others can inherit, more especially in cattle. They can inherit other things. Meanwhile, leaving also the woman on the street without even caring for the children of the family, without even paying school fee, even health, even other kinds of responsibilities.
Some widows in South Sudan who are inherited by their husband's brother continue to produce children for their in-laws. Most of the women involved in the wife inheritance this program spoke with had little to no choice during the process. South Sudan women also face challenges over property inheritance. Article 16, Section 5 of the South Sudan Constitution stipulates that women shall have the right to own property and share in the land of their deceased husbands together with any survival legal beneficiary of the deceased. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa reporting from the Eastern Equatorial State Capital, Torit.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, the United Nations Human Rights Council says South Sudanese leaders have a huge task ahead of them. Find out why after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Our words of wisdom for today comes from Central Equatorial State.
Good afternoon, VOA. This is Ronyo Charles John from Kajokeji County, Central Equatorial State, and Kuku by tribe. I'm here to present my proverb in Kuku language, which says, Kodo tojore iukwele lulo, kodo dungu, akwa kena denda na gweban, which is translated that if you fill your head with pride, you will lack space for wisdom. This means that in life, you should not be proud. You should be a person who is fit in the community to make sure that everybody loves you. This proverb is a nice one and it's very good in our Kuku tribe. Thank you.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The United Nations Human Rights Council on South Sudan says the two-year extension of South Sudan's transitional period presents another opportunity for South Sudanese leaders to consolidate peace, uphold human rights protection, and transform the country. Bani Afako says he expects the transitional government of national unity to show commitment by addressing rights abuses in the country.
The leaders and the signatories of the agreement who are now sharing power in Juba were supposed to implement certain core commitments in the agreement. For example, to establish a unified security service, both military and other arms of security. They were supposed to take steps to restructure the government and the management of its resources, including economic resources. They were supposed to embark on a constitution-making process so that for the first time South Sudanese can contribute to defining their country and their future through a fundamental legal text of the constitution. They were also supposed to take steps to deal with the violations that have taken place since December 2013 through the establishment of a hybrid court, through the establishment of the Truth Commission and a body for reparations. Now, on all of these matters, the leaders have lagged behind. There have been delays, there have been obstructions, and that's why 6 years down the line, we're asking for another 2 more years to make it 8. And therefore, if it is business as usual, if the leaders go back to delay, if they go back to a lack of consensus and a lack of investment in the rights of the Sudanese, South Sudanese people, then this doesn't bode well at all.
There's a strong quote here in the press release from Chairperson Yasmin Soka. She said, since independence in 2011, South Sudan's unelected leaders have continued to entrench impunity for systemic and gross human rights violation, fuel insecurity, and deliberately dwarf efforts to democratize the country. That statement is quite strong there. The leaders in South Sudan say they have not done much because of challenges ranging from lack of resources, the war in Sudan, the challenges of implementing the peace agreement. How do you categorize them in that situation, given their conditions?
You see, that statement is not made lightly. If you go back over our reports, every successive year, there has been violence, there have been conflicts in most parts of South Sudan, one part or another. When the conflict moved out of Juba with the signing of an agreement, it reemerged as conflict in communities, often orchestrated by elite competition. This has led to displacement of many South Sudanese. Some have gone into exile and we meet them in neighboring countries, but some are internally displaced. And this is all under the oversight of the transitional government since the signing of the agreement. You talk about constraints, but South Sudan is not a poor country. It's an oil-rich country, but a lot of the resources we see are routinely diverted away from fulfilling the rights of South Sudanese people to other projects.
Your statement is actually a wake-up call to the signatories of the 2018 peace agreement to do more during the extended 24 months. What is it that you would like them to do better this time around?
Really quite simple. It's a question of the political will. You've reached an agreement that South Sudan needs to emerge as a new society based on consensus of the will of the people. Why did we start with that? Complete the process of the unifications of the military, of the army, of the security services, so that a new people's force
emerges in South Sudan, so that the security sector serves the people of South Sudan rather than repressing them. Instead, we've seen a bill introduced and a law passed for the National Security Service that extends its powers to make arrests and to detain people in ways that we fear will only be used to silence dissent and to target those who are perceived to have different views from the official regime. These choices that are being made, and we say they're being made deliberately, undermine the prospects of democracy.
That's Benny Afakko, Commissioner at the United Nations Human Rights Council for South Sudan. He spoke with me from Uganda this past hour. In his last speech as president before the 79th session of the United Nations General Assembly, President Joe Biden made a call to the international community to speak with one voice and tell the warring generals in Sudan to stop tearing their country apart. Here is our reporter at the UN, Margaret Bashir.
Yeah, the president was very strong on Sudan. He said the world needs to stop arming the two generals that are fighting there, and the international community must speak with one voice and tell them to stop tearing their country apart, to stop blocking aid to their people, and to end the war. And he said this to a lot of applause in the General Assembly Hall. Today, there's a meeting being co-hosted by the UN Humanitarian Office and the Refugee Agency, along with the United States and the African Union, the European Union, the Egyptians and the Saudis, and that's about the humanitarian response. And U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield just announced at this meeting an additional $424 million for the emergency response in Sudan and in the neighboring countries, which have taken over 2 million refugees from Sudan and returnees. So that was a major announcement. And the United Nations also announced that they are giving $18 million from their Central Emergency Relief Fund to the Sudan crisis. There is a lot of concern here about the deteriorating food security situation.
And now that you mentioned U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, she's actually leading a U.S. effort to expand the Security Council with two seats for Africa.
Yeah, she made that announcement last week in a speech in New York. And on Sunday, the U.N. General Assembly at their Summit of the Future, they adopted this wide-ranging pact called the Pact for the Future. And one of the key elements in it is about reforming the Security Council, about the need to make it more representative, inclusive, efficient, specifically says to redress the historical injustice against Africa as a priority. And that's because when the Security Council and the United Nations were born after World War II, a lot of countries in Africa were not yet independent, and they were living under colonial rule at that time. And so they didn't have real representation on the council. They were never considered for a permanent seat. And so over decades, there has been a push here for more representation for not just Africa, but from the global south in general. Latin America would like to have a permanent seat. Asia would like one. Say, look, the world has changed. It's almost 100 years, you know, since the Security Council was developed, established. So there's a real momentum now to see a permanent seat, at least one for Africa. The United States, you're right, Linda Thomas-Greenfield said in her speech last week that the United States, the Biden administration, is ready to support two. But there's one caveat. They're not willing to support a veto. So new permanent members would not have a veto in the U.S. perspective. And I think we can be pretty sure Russia and China would agree with them on that. Maybe France and the British might be a little more amenable to some sort of sharing of the veto. They're not as attached to their veto as the other three are. They haven't used it, in fact, since 1989.
That's Margaret Bashir, our UN reporter. She spoke with my colleague, Yahya Zwihub, from New York. The Uncommitted National Movement that began as a protest against President Joe Biden's policies on the war in Gaza announced last week they will not endorse Vice President Kamala Harris, the Democratic presidential candidate. Another pro-Palestinian group, Abandon Harris, says they are working to ensure her defeat. Could these movements impact election results in the battleground states? White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widakwaswara brings this story from Michigan, the state with the highest percentage of Arab Americans.
Dearborn, Michigan is known as the Arab capital of America. In this Arab-majority city, in a state that is home to almost 400,000 Arab Americans, many are angry over U.S. policies on the war in Gaza. Abdallah Doleh is a Palestinian American.
I'm not happy with what's happening, and I'm not really hopeful anything is going to change anytime soon. Even if Kamala Harris comes into play, I don't think she's going to be capable to do a whole lot of change.
I will not be silent.
Kamala Harris's campaign has been targeting Dearborn with ads showing her sympathy to the suffering in Gaza.
Vice President Harris has chosen a side.
But a political group with Republican ties is also targeting those voters with ads highlighting Harris' support for Israel and the Jewish faith of her husband, Doug Emhoff.
We can trust she'll always support Israel.
The ads appear aimed at the 100,000 Michiganders who voted uncommitted in the Democratic primary election to protest the Biden administration's support of Israel's military campaign. When Harris visited Michigan last week, the Uncommitted National Movement announced they will not endorse her.
Myself, a Palestinian American, that, I've been a lifelong Democrat. I would love to be part of the voting bloc that elects the very first black female president. But Vice President Harris has not shown me that she will protect people I care about.
Harris says she supports both Israeli security and Palestinian rights.
President Biden and I are working to end this war such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination.
While not endorsing Harris, the uncommitted group also opposes Donald Trump, who they fear is even more supportive of Israel.
When I'm back in the Oval Office, I will support Israel's right to win its war on terror. They have to have a right to win the war.
Another pro-Palestinian group, Abandon Harris, says it's working to ensure her defeat, even if it means a Trump victory. Co-chair Farah Khan.
I don't think there's any difference in policy when it comes to Palestine or foreign policy when you talk about these two. They're equally evil. So it doesn't really matter to me.
Abandon Harris is encouraging voters to support anti-war third-party candidates, such as Green Party nominee Jill Stein.
In this swing state, Harris and Trump are virtually tied in the polls. In 2020, Biden won over Trump by 154,000 votes. And in 2016, Trump won over Hillary Clinton by just under 11,000 votes.
But losing votes over Gaza may not necessarily mean Harris loses Michigan. The United Automobile Workers Labor Union, a key political force in the state, has endorsed her, and her campaign is working to boost support from black voters. Ronald Stockton is professor emeritus at the University of Michigan.
If the black turnout goes up and Arab American voting goes down for the Democrats, will those cancel each other out? I don't know. With the unions out there banging on the doors and doing everything they can, the UAW, that's going to make a difference.
Another variable would be Trump making inroads with Arab and Muslim voters. Amir Ghalib, the Yemeni-American mayor of Hamtramck, endorsed Trump after meeting him last week. The endorsement carries symbolic significance. The city of Hamtramck is home to 30,000 people, many of them Muslim. It's the only city in the country to have an all-Muslim city council. Patsy Widakuswara and Rifan Duyastono, VOA News, Michigan.
That's all from us this Wednesday, September 25th, 2024. We now leave you with Genesis the Veteran and the song Sambala Sambala. For more on our programs, visit www.voaafrica.com. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Rob Macklin, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.